Thank you. Thank you for having me here. So today I'm going to talk mostly about how you can probe ring down, how you can probe a strong field gravity with gravitational wave ring down. The big picture question is always the same, which is like, can we test GR in the strong field regime and at short distances? And in the context of this particular talk, when I mean short distances, I mean a scale that is slightly larger than the event horizon, not any Planckian scale. So essentially, the question is, can we test them? Till about a few months ago, we didn't have a few years ago, we didn't have a very good handle on testing strong field gravity in the scale of black hole horizon. And since the gravitational wave detection, ring downs serve as a very powerful tool to perform such tests.
We can see it as a check against the wall.
Hmm? Oh, yeah, maybe the wall one is loose. Hmm. It doesn't seem to make much of a difference.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. I think we can see things, it just looks this yellowish. Not sure why. And I think this is fine. Yeah, sorry.
Turn the lights.
I think it's the right mode for the.
It's something with the projector.
Yeah. Okay. Just your white is yellow now. That's okay.
Okay.
So if you have both white and yellow, we cannot distinguish them, which is, I think.
That should be fine, I think. Okay. So when two binary, so what you're seeing here is the famous first detection of gravitational wave, GW1914. This is a signal that you get when two black holes go around each other and they merge. And then the final merged remnant, merged black hole settles down into a final state. Now, the portion of the signal that I'm interested in is in the post-merger. That's like if the peak of the waveform corresponds to somewhere close to merger, I am interested in the part of the signal that comes after that. So just those last few cycles. So what you're seeing here is like when two black holes merge, they first merge to form a highly deformed black hole. And this highly deformed black hole then settles down, rings, and settles down to final state. And in this process, the initial state when my black holes are highly deformed, the dynamics of this particular stage can only be handled with numerical relativity when you have the full Einstein's equation. However, as the ring down proceeds, as the deformations decay down, and there comes a point when I can start treating them as I can model this as the final curve black hole spacetime plus some linear perturbation on it. So for the rest of the talk, when I mean ring down, I mean when the black holes have already reached a state when I can mathematically model them as final curve spacetime plus linear perturbations on it. So.
So is that number of cycles typical, you know, for the ring down phase?
Typically, you know, three to six, yeah. Yeah, a few cycles.
Okay.
Order of 3 to 6 cycles is what you see generally.
The question is how much of it you can see, the exponentially damped. Is that,
they are exponentially damped.
Because your noise is some level.
Yeah, that's the, yeah.
So for instance, when we had, for instance, in this particular signal, the actual clearly visible cycles were just up to around this, like
yeah,
first
exactly.
1.5-2 cycles were what we could see.
For larger speeds, so that if you turn it up as high as you can,
mm-hmm.
then the decay rate goes slower and slower.
Okay.
So then it's going to go. So the number of cycles would not change, or might not significantly change, but now it's going to be over a much longer time scale.
Oh, so like, is that worse then for LIGO? Because then it's like out of band, or is it still in
No, band? Because then you have the R now, which is the mass. So for the right mass and the right speed, you
okay.
can
say that, yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so then, so what are ring dance? So ring dance are when I can model the final black hole merger as final black hole spacetime plus some linear perturbation. And we understand how exactly these perturbations evolve because they are the solutions to this famous Tucholsky's equation. And far, far away at asymptotic infinity, these just look like sum of damped sinusoids. And I can express them like that, where YLM is the spherical harmonic mode. So a unique feature about the ring dance are that they have each mode is characterized by a unique frequency and damping. And this and given a final mass and spin of the black hole, the frequency and damping are uniquely determined. Whereas the amplitude depends on your initial condition of initial perturbation condition. So in this case, the initial perturbation condition is given by the merger of the two black holes. So because it is given by the initial condition of merger of the two black holes, and we know that the gravitational radiation, the dominant part is the quadrupolar mode, the 2-2 ring down mode, 2-2 spheroidal harmonic decomposition is what dominates, which is a dominant mode of ring down. So, and the combination of these frequencies and damping is what we call as the quasi-normal spectrum, and it's unique for a given final mass and final spin. So this slide is just to tell you that we completely understand how the frequency spectrum is, how the quasi-normal mode frequency spectrum is for a curved black hole. What you're seeing essentially is the x-axis is the dimensionless spin divided by the mass, and the y-axis is the quasi-normal mode frequency. And over here you're seeing the same thing, dimensionless spin divided by the final mass of the black hole. And on the y-axis, you see the quality factor, which is related to the damping of the ring down. So essentially, given any spin, I can tell you what exactly the spectrum of quasi-normal mode should look like. So this provides, if we see these modes in our gravitational wave signal, this is a very powerful test of the strong field region of gravity, like our understanding of how gravity behaves in the strong field region close to the black hole. Specifically, what we will be testing is we'll be testing if Tucholsky's perturbation equations are right, which also means we'll be checking the effective black hole potential. And we will be checking if the boundary conditions that we use for solving these are correct. And the boundary condition is generally you have no outgoing radiation at the event horizon and no ingoing at the asymptotic infinity. And since no outgoing at the event horizon is like quintessential property of an absorptive black hole horizon, we will be testing that if the final object is a black hole in certain ways. So naturally, because this is a very powerful test of testing relativity, we tried performing this on the first signal that we had, GW15 and 914. So what happened is, first of all, it's not very clear when we should begin a ring down. Like when does your signal start looking like it's in the perturbative regime? So the thing that was done was we picked a bunch of here in this particular slide. When I say we, I mean the collaboration. We tried different start time of the ring down. And what you're seeing here is the quasi-normal mode frequency that has been recovered from the signal, and the y-axis shows you the quasi-normal damping of what we saw in the signal. The black curve over here is what we predict theoretically. So, and each of these contours, the colored contours that you see, are what happens when you pick different start time of the ring down. So what happened was sadly the ring down of this particular signal was not very strong. We had an SNR of just 8.5, which is very small. And as a consequence, the spread in the estimation of the quasi-normal mode frequency was about 45 hertz. This is a large, large spread in frequency to do any kind of precision test of GR.
You can pick many quasi-normal mode sets. So you have picked here a particular mass and particular A.
So for this black curve, what we do is we take the in spiral part and we calculate what should be the final mass and final spin according to relativity.
So you're using the in spiral part?
Yeah.
It's the full thing, isn't it?
Which one?
Is it just in spiral or is it just the full?
The whole IMR waveform and right. Then you see what the final mass and final spin should be. And this is just given by numerical relativity.
Right.
So that's what you get out of this one. And these things are like you're trying to just estimate what is the frequency content and what is the damping content in the data.
Right, yeah?
But I mean, you could have done a different exercise,
mm-hmm.
right, where I just pick 3 milliseconds after merger,
mm-hmm.
and then I try to look for the spin out of it, or the mass out of it. So they have
spin and total mass, right? So people have done that as well. There are, again, huge contours that agree with each other, but you know, it's like a huge spread. And now I'm also currently involved in developing some of the parameter estimations for ringdown, and we are trying to fine-tune it to figure out which is a better parameter to use, whether it's the mass and spin or whether it is individual frequencies. And yeah, it's an ongoing project. We're trying to do this. But that is a very valid thing we can do. But one thing that was very certain was that we did see a damped sinusoid. Like if you do a model selection against a Gaussian noise versus a damped sinusoid, you have a huge base factor of log base factor 14.
Right, but the question I have there is that you could have damped sinusoids, but here you're assuming something else. It's a damped sinusoids and that the signal is linear in this quasi-normal mode, non-basis.
Mm-hmm.
But you could imagine enriching that where they have now products of the individual modes, because we know that quasi-normal modes are not a basis. So
yeah.
You already start the fight on the losing end, and I can never win. And so these tricks are in some sense
not optimal.
That problem. So,
right.
I mean, you could have, so, and we know that the system is still nonlinear. You're assuming the nonlinearities are sublinear.
So,
but
yeah.
You have, mm-hmm. Coupling of modes.
Like modes beating against each other just by power leaking and stuff. Yeah, that is possible, but the fact that this is how much spread you're seeing in the dominant mode. A system like this, okay, this system is particularly special because it's like an equal mass system. So the subdominant modes are supposed to be very small. Like,
but even say the mode would itself.
The mode, say that again?
I think your point is like the green curve is a reflection of that, because if you
start
from
So
the curves are a reflection of, I mean, starting with an incomplete.
Incomplete basis set.
And already an assumption of linearity,
mm-hmm.
which, okay.
For instance, if I take a nonlinear regime, which is like 1 millisecond after the merger, I do see a discrepancy, right? So where we begin the ring down is a question that I'll try to address later on in the talk. But even in the linear regime, what you're saying is true, that I can have power leaking between the modes, and I can have an effective frequency that's picked up in a wrong way. For instance, one of the things that we see right now when we are trying to develop the parameter estimation pipeline is that if I inject two modes, which are kind of very strong, and try to do a recovery with single mode, we do get quite a bit of bias in the parameter that's been estimated.
And am I understanding this plot correctly? That as the further, oh, because you're losing signal.
So
it's getting worse with time.
Because as you go further on, you're increasing the statistical error. So it's kind of an interplay between what you want to have as a modeling error and what you want to have as a statistical error. So between those two, you need to pick when you want to start your ring down.
If you use like a more physical basis, like he's saying, then that that uncertainty, in your start time wouldn't be so significant.
But it's a natural basis to use, like.
Physics is going after me.
Yeah, deviation.
What is a more physical basis?
Also, like mass and spin or something like that, like you're saying.
No, but I was saying we're still using the quasi-normal modes, because one thing she wants to do is that, I think it went too quickly, but those coefficients in terms of or the decay rate and all that, they're all determined by the single set of parameters. So if you mention one quasi-normal mode, then you should know what the other ones are.
Yeah, like I should be able to measure one.
Roughly the first two.
But there's like many possible physical parameters.
Yeah, they're all fixed with the M and A. So you can extract M and A From one?
From one, yeah.
CDR are consistent with it.
Yeah, so essentially the idea would be that. Idea would be to extract M and A from like two modes separately. Like I need two independent parameters, which will be the frequency and damping of each mode. And so both, you know, each one of those modes will give me a mass and a spin. And then see if these two are consistent with each other. Because if these two are, then I know that all of, at least these two modes can be parameterized by just two parameters, which is what my Noether theorem says that should be the case.
In the complex exponential, the imaginary part of the frequency is the damping. The real part is, what about the real part of the frequency?
This is the real part of the frequency, right? And that's coming out of the damping.
So it's...
Okay.
So is there something like the PPN extension in this regime?
Well,
these are just like frequencies as opposed to like physical.
PPN expansion is before the.
Yeah, I understand. I'm just like an analog of that. For,
so here, what you've done is just you have a single black hole.
Yeah.
So you're doing, you're
sort of
expanding
about that
equation.
Back time.
Yeah,
that,
over that black hole, what are the old modes that I can.
Right.
And so they have a many eigenmodes.
That's right.
But because energy is being lost, they're quasi-normal modes as opposed to normal
modes. Normal modes, yeah.
Right. I guess I was just
and
wondering
there
if there's like some basis you can use.
I mean,
to
people right now
like
are trying to do a parameterized, develop something for parameterized framework, but nothing exists as of now to do the ring down part in a, like in a PPN, for like in a parameterized framework. We don't have any as of now.
Yeah, so maybe an example of Fourier. So I could use Fourier, right? So I have lots of bases. I can represent anything that's going on in terms of Fourier. But then the coefficients will tell me anything about physics. So while these things, when you latch onto this one, they're telling me all the linear regime. And it also is understood that they are not the basis. But as you wait longer and longer, the failure to be a basis gets to be smaller and smaller as well. So eventually.
The nonlinearity, you're saying, becomes.
Right, so all these RMOs just they came much too quickly, and then you should be. Capturing the behavior by this quasi normal.
Yeah.
Thanks. Sorry.
No, it's okay. So now naturally the question is, we did not see it in GW150914 signal, which is unusually loud. We didn't expect a signal this loud. So the next question is, do we actually hope to see this in future? And then if yes, then how do you actually do this test? You will have a bunch of conceptual problems and a bunch of implementation problems. So the two things that I have worked on is the first one, where can we do the test? And among the conceptual problem, one particular problem that is of that I find very interesting and I've worked on is, when does the ring down signal start? So the two questions I'll be trying to address. The first one, I'll just state the result, but the second one, I'll go to details. And at the end of the talk, if we do have some time, I'll go over some of the implementation challenges, which is something that I'm working on currently. Okay. So the prospects of ring down. So we tried injecting about 1 million signals in the sky and trying to recover the frequency and damping of these and seeing how many of them are such that you can see more than two modes. And the results are the following, that if you have an optimistic merger binary black hole merger rate, then when the current state of LIGO upgrades to what its design sensitivity is, which is like three times more than what it was, you will see about three events every year that might allow you to detect more than two modes. This is an optimistic rate.
That allows you to detect more than two modes?
More than two modes.
What scenario are you asking for?
So I'm asking for the fact, I'm asking that each of the mode should have an SNR greater than 5. So even the so essentially the dominant mode is probably going to have much larger SNR, but the subdominant mode has to have an SNR of 5. So essentially it is optimistic, but we are still at the mercy of the rates for advanced LIGO. You know, for a future generation detector like Cosmic Explorer and Einstein Telescope, or even for that matter, the first upgrade to the LIGO, which is called an A+ detector, we have a very good chance. Like even if you take the pessimistic rate of 13 events in a megaparsec cube per year, you still see about 4 to 60 events. And to answer the question of which of the subdominant mode can you see, it looks like 3-3 and 2-1 are most probably the ones that you will see. This is assuming the initial binary mergings are equal mass binary. Sorry, uniform prior on the equal initial masses. So now, having seen that we might have a chance of doing a ring down analysis, I will move on to this particular question of when does the ring down start. So mostly, the way the state of art right now has been that people are looking at all of this from the data analysis side, which is like to figure out when to start the ring down, you either make curves like you saw there of different start time and seeing when you start having all curves enclosed into each other, or people like, for instance, Leon and London have been trying to look at chi-square fitting of when does a quasi-normal, you know, damped sinusoid fit to the signal that you see. But I was kind of interested in seeing if we can get any handle on this looking at the source frame dynamics from numerical relativity. So essentially, the idea was that, so a very basic idea was that if I have a waveform like this, and generally what happens is you see all of this happening in the numerical relativity, in the strong field region, in a very small space around the black hole. And then you extract this out by doing some kind of an extraction, right? And there is no one-to-one map between this. And surely enough, you shouldn't be expecting to have a one-to-one map because, you know, you're dealing with a nonlinear theory.
One-to-one map of what, sorry?
What happens in the source frame and what you see in the asymptotic frame. Like, can I identify anything better than this? Can I say that this one comes from this particular dynamics? Now, this is not a very well-posed question in the sense that I'm looking at a nonlinear theory, but the idea is how much can you do this?
Sorry, I still don't understand. What is a one-to-one mapping you're looking for?
So I want to see what happens. So as I evolve a numerical relativity simulation, if I can see how the geometry of the space-time changes in the strong field region around the black hole, can I map the states of space-time close to the black hole and say that, okay, this is how the space-time was looking when this is the dominant source that produced this feature. Like approximately, this is what mostly contribute. This particular dynamics in the source frame is what contributed to this thing. Like, can I say this part corresponds to when the source? So essentially, the idea is like when you look at it from a linear perturbation point of view, you see that, and if you have a swash shell black hole, and if you are trying to plunge it with a test particle, an understanding is that when the test particle is crossing the light ring, your effective radial potential, that's what is responsible for the dominant effect of your quasi-normal mode, right? So essentially, if I really want to look at when I start being in my perturbative region, one good thing to do would be to see some place close to the black hole that has a good support of the potential, and see when does this potential start looking like what I expect the final Kerr black hole to have.
So, sorry, I'm being dense, but so I'm not sure what you want, but let me just change the question.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an old problem, so can you hear the shape of a drum, right? And the answer is no.
Yeah.
So you're trying, are you thinking?
I am trying to see.
So if the answer is no there, what is the chance it would be yes here?
Okay, so technically the answer is a no, right? But can I get any handle at all? Yes, it's a mathematically ill-defined problem, but how far can I go with this? Okay.
I think you're asking something simpler. Is that can you connect one point in the curve below to one point on the picture above?
Exactly. Exactly.
I think that's also just saying that. Is there one
exactly
point that connects? And yeah, I mean, I think roughly this is true, but I guess maybe not exactly.
Yeah. So exactly, it cannot be true because I'm talking about a nonlinear theory. I'll have scattering, you know, back.
Yeah.
You know, backscattering from all the points. But can I identify at least the dominant source, saying that, okay, this phenomena is made, like, you know, most of the contribution is coming from this phenomena, plus there'll be some backscatter from here and there. Kind
I guess
of
the only real thing you're going after is to say, can I identify something going on in the near region?
to what happens at asymptotic
now
infinity.
Now I can assume it's a linear problem.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, can I see it in the source frame that I'm approaching a linear theory? And can I say that when I'm approaching in the linear theory in the source frame, can I kind of make a connection about this probably lies approximately at this point of the waveform? So I'm trying to make that connection.
This question has been asked before. I mean, and Carlos Lustov and Manuela Campanelli, they create all these specialty indices. And
that's exactly what I'll be talking
about
very soon. So essentially, the first question is, can you even quantify the source frame as being curl-like? Because at this point, you're doing a manifold classification. You're asking whether or not each of your time slices during a numerical evolution, does that resemble locally to a curl spacetime? Right? So first, we have to deal with how to characterize a spacetime as a curl manifold. And then once we do that, the next problem we have to deal with is how do you want to connect a source frame to what you see far away in this future null infinity region? So that's essentially the problem, because here this is the time axis. You evolve with time. These are the spatial slices which evolve. And this is the small region of spacetime that is generally evolved through numerical relativity. And the first question that we want to ask is, if I'm given the slice, can I tell how close is it to a stationary curl spacetime? Now, this has been a hard question for a while, but a few, about a year ago, there was this paper from a Spanish group, which gave a complete characterization of how you can characterize a manifold locally to a curl black hole. So it involved a bunch of these steps, and the really nice thing about this particular paper that these people wrote was that they gave us a 3+1 decomposition of it, so it was naturally useful to implement it in a numerical relativity framework. So the way I do this, the way we do this is the following: you start out with any generic spacetime, any generic manifold, and then you check for something called a spatiality index, which tells you, which quantifies whether the manifold is algebraically special or not. Then from once I know that they are algebraically special, I put certain restrictions, which are given in terms of four conditions, type D1, type D3, and type D4. And then I can sub-classify the manifold into a special set called as a Petrov D spacetime. Kerr manifold, for instance, is a subset of this bigger class. And from there, I impose some more conditions on the killing vectors to figure out if it is a Carnot spacetime, which is a broader class in which Kerr belongs. And then there are two more conditions I need to evaluate to figure out that it is Kerr. So this one uniquely lets me find this particular algorithm that was proposed in this paper uniquely lets me characterize whether I'm locally isometric to a Kerr metric.
If you have the metric exactly.
If I have the metric exactly. So I will be evaluating this at each point in numerical simulation evolution of binary black hole system. We have taken GW59 and 14. So we have the metric and the first derivative of metric, and we are doing this with spec. We have the volume data for it. So we actually have metric and its first derivative at each point through the evolution.
I mean, numerical simulations are great, of course, but there's always an error.
Well, but my question is, suppose it's perfect.
Uh-huh.
You have the perfect simulation. What this algorithm will tell you is when you are at Kerr. But that's not your question. Your question is, when are you sufficiently close to Kerr per curve to then say, oh, I can trust my Poisson mode search?
Exactly.
So you just change the source of the problem. Before you said, oh, if I see this decay, mm-hmm. I don't know when I should say, oh,
I'll come to that. This is the first step you need to do. You need to at least be able to quantify how far away you are from Kerr in some quantifiable way to begin talking about our unit perturbation region, right?
Right, but this is, so far it's exactly the same problem. So here you're saying, when can you quantify this way as opposed to when going to quantify it on from the side of a gravitational wave?
Mm-hmm. I'll come to that. Right? This is just the equation which I won't probably talk about. Okay, so this is, what you're seeing here is the first panel is when the black holes have, So each of these conditions that you see, so each of these conditions that you see are like a condition that all of them go to zero when it's curve. So each of these speciality index have type D1, type D2, all of these have been designed so that they go to zero when I'm in a perfect curve.
How many of them are there?
So there are 8 of them, but we will figure out that there are 6 that matter, and then you can kind of break them into, if you look at the behavior of it, there's one speciality index, which is separate, and then it breaks into 2 categories of one that checks the algebraic speciality of the spacetime, and one that checks the geometry of the spacetime. So essentially it boils down to having 5 conditions.
5 conditions.
5 conditions. Yeah. So what you're seeing is point-wise, we evaluate. So here I'm just showing you 3 of them, speciality index, type D1, which is a quantifier of algebraic measure, and curve 1, which is a quantifier of geometric measure. Now we have 2 more of these and 2 more of these, but they behave similarly, so I'm just showing you 1 of them. The first panel is when all of these conditions are violated the maximum, which I call as 100% violation, and then this is when the black holes have, binary black holes have, like, you know, the merger has ringed down so that the violation of space-time is only 1%. So this is kind of quantifying how close I am to the final curve black hole that I've formed. So now the next slide is, can I map points on this to events that happen there? The way I will do this is the following. So the small region of space-time where I'm doing the Cauchy evolution, I have, these are the time slices that evolve. And so say I have a label tau naught for one particular slice. The way I will connect them to what happens at asymptotic infinity is via the outgoing null characteristic, the outgoing light cone. So essentially, since I can label each of these with the time slice they connect to, I will place a label on each of these null slices, indicating what time slice they correspond to in the source frame, and then therefore I can map on that label onto the waveform. So this particular thing has been done by a small modification to the Cauchy characteristic extraction scheme. So this is how I do it. Now the point is, generally a Cauchy characteristic extraction, or, you know, people do this kind of an algorithm to extract gravitational wave, but that's generally done from far enough when you are not in a strong field region and when you don't have a lot of nonlinear dynamics. So you generally, you do it from about 300 to 500 m or even later. So the idea was, let's push that boundary in as far as we can.
Oh, and that's going to be bad.
It's not that bad.
It is bad for a bunch of reasons, right? So the one reason, so you could have caustics all that, but we don't really know. The reason why you do extraction at very far distance, I mean, I know this was part of my thesis,
mm-hmm.
is that we don't really know how to do the matching correctly. So you're just extracting, you're never injecting.
Yes. You will. So the first slice will always have the zero ingoing conditions.
But in addition to that, right? So if you, the characteristic needs boundary conditions from
the scattering from here, you're saying.
The Cauchy needs boundary conditions on its side to the evolution. So if you push it that way,
mm-hmm.
you're now going into kind of the more nonlinear regime. And we don't have control. That problem is unsolved at this moment. How to do, and this is what Niaj was asking me recently, we don't know how to do a boundary consistent with general relativity.
So you're worried about the reflections, right?
Yeah.
You're worried about scatters that go that way.
And the
right?
opposite, yeah.
Yeah, all of that. That
from the Cauchy, bounces
so,
off that boundary comes back in.
Yeah, so the thing that we did was, okay, first of all, I can't go indefinitely inside. We see that so the extraction that we have managed to do that is reasonable is up to R is equal to 5m. Beyond that, I have the caustic formation. But to check the precise point that you're saying, how much does my backscatter affect and stuff, I have also done multiple extractions, like at 5, at 25, at 64, 95, 128, and 300. And I see that in each of these situations, if I do a waveform extraction, but
well, you're just doing extraction. You're not doing matching.
Okay, okay, okay. One second. I think.
The boundary, your question boundary is still far.
No, no, no. Wait. I think I know the answer to your question. We don't simulate the waveform only in this region, actually. We have a simulation that spans up to 500 m.
Oh,
I'm only taking the world tube boundary at this point. So I, you know.
You're just extracting a different.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just going inwards in the extraction radius. So like a point over here in the strong field region, I know the scattering over there. The thing I was talking about was I do one assumption, which is that I set the first slice to have no ingoing and no outgoing radiation. So I do miss out on what happens during the in-spiral. Like if I pick it over here, then I don't get the in-spiral part that comes from there. So, and for that, we have checked by doing multiple things and seeing how much it differs. It does differ a little bit, but not enough for us to be worried about for a project of this sort. Okay, so now I have a scheme to map what happens if I can characterize that a slice tau naught is away from Kerr by some quantifier k naught, then I can tell you this point on the waveform comes roughly through the source when the source region looks is that much far away from being a Kerr black hole. So I can connect it that way. Now, so what you see here is the mapping done in the fashion that I explained. The top curves are how each of these kernels measures, or each of these conditions that I put to quantify whether it's Kerr or not, change in the source frame. So those are the curves that I have on the top panel. And the bottom...
At what point are those calculated?
So these are calculated as a surface integral on a sphere of 5m. So essentially I'm saying, does a sphere of 5m that encloses the black hole, how different does that surface look from what it would have been if it's a Kerr black hole? Ideally, you would want to go in slightly more inwards, like closer to the black light ring, but you know, you have cost deformation, you can't use this particular formalism to do that. Probably the right thing would be to do the ingoing light cone, not an outgoing light cone, like we did. So the idea is, so on the bottom panel is the gravitational wave that you see out at asymptotic infinity. And the thing to note here is that all of them have the same time axis. So this time axis is similar. So this is the one that is mapped from the Cauchy simulation gauge. So this point at, say, 3840, the waveform has this kind of a feature. And this maps to this particular value of kernels, each of them. So what you see is these lines show different percentage decreases. This is the pink one is when all the measures are at their 100%. And as you go, the last one that you see is when it is at 1%, when all of the measures have decayed up to 1%. Now, one small thing that I wanted to point out is that these two are algebraic measures. They kind of behave similarly, or they at least decay similarly. These two are geometric measures. They kind of decay similarly. But there's slight difference between how these two compare with each other. So now the question is, these are some measures, these are some constraints that are getting violated to a certain extent. How does this connect to the perturbation amplitude? Because, you know, if I tell you that type D1 condition is violated by, you know, 2^(−7), it doesn't mean anything mostly, right? So the next thing is, how do you want to connect these to perturbation amplitude? So the way we do this is we take an analytical Kerr black hole solution, and then we superimpose a linear perturbation on this. So essentially, this is like you solve Tucholsky's equation to get the quadrinormal modes. You do a metric reconstruction, and then what you do is we also do a constraint solving to get the final thing. So essentially, it's just an initial slice of numerical simulation with the Kerr black hole spacetime and linear perturbation. Here, I can change the perturbation amplitude by hand. Like, I have a control on how much perturbation amplitude I can put in. So what we do is we calculate, we make this Kerr plus a perturbation of varying perturbation amplitudes. And on each of this amplitude at each point, we calculate again how each of these constraints are violated. So for instance, now the idea would be, if when I put a perturbation of epsilon naught, I find that a sphere of 5m has a curvedness of k naught, or like deviates from curve by a k naught. And in a binary black hole merger, say I see that at time t naught, I have the same violation k naught. Then that the time slice t naught kind of maps, you know, approximately has a perturbation amplitude of epsilon naught. Now, so that's how, and once I can map a perturbation amplitude to the time slice, then I know how to connect the time slice to the waveform by what I just explained, right? So now this is just to show you how similar or different analytical perturbation looks to a binary black hole ring down. So this is the same. So this column you see the black hole perturbation, analytical black hole with a linear perturbation on it, and this is what you see in a binary black hole ring down. So here this is like I decrease the amplitude of perturbation, and here it evolves in time. So what you see is, it does look like it's good enough to map in certain way, but it's not exact. I can't really map a linear perturbation, a space-time of linear perturbation onto a black hole ring down precisely, but it is similar enough that I can draw intuition from them.
You can run what?
I can derive some intuition from how strong the perturbation amplitude is in the source frame from this. Right, like so these two are plotted at the same value of the Kerness measures. These two are plotted at the same value of the Kerness measure. So at a, you know, both of these have violated the Kerr space time by X amount, the same amount. And this is similar enough, but not exact. The fact that this is not exact leads to, so if I could have mapped these two precisely, if the left hand and the right hand figures were exactly the same, then when I map them onto the waveform, this would have been a line, just a line. It would have been like, it would have marked exactly where the amplitude would have been.
So what is n of t?
N of t is the Neuse function, which is just the first derivative of your gravitational wave that you see.
This is at infinity, or
so this is the waveform at infinity. So this is this is just the Pontineuse function that you get out of, right? So you would have seen this as a line. So what I want to see you is,
sir, explain that. Why a line? What do you mean
a
line?
So if I can say that a perturbation of k naught exactly maps on to the space-time of black hole evolution at time t naught, then what you're seeing here essentially is each of these colored bands correspond to a perturbation amplitude that I'm putting in. Okay, so then I should be able to, I would, if they had corresponded exactly, then I could have told you that at this particular time the amplitude is this much. But now since you see that in this picture they are not exactly same, they're slightly different. This is a plot of Psi 4, by the way. Slightly different. What happens is the estimation of time from this has some error. So this is the error of, so in between this band, I have an amplitude of 7.5 into 10 power minus 3-ish number. And this band is when my perturbation amplitude is 5 into 10 power minus 3, for instance. So I can map the source frame perturbation amplitude with this kind of an error bar onto the waveform.
So what I worry about is this a gauge invariant assessment?
So yes, picking the sphere of 5m, that's definitely not a gauge invariant thing, because it depends on what simulation
but
gauge.
But also amplitude of perturbations in different gauges.
Amplitude of perturbation is, yes, there's a normalization for it, but it doesn't matter because all of them will have the same thing. So I'm kind of mapping. So the important thing here is that I cannot put a perturbation greater than this. I see that my Tucholsky's equation, I start getting a lapse that has a negative value. So I know that before this, if you pick a point, you're definitely violating a linear perturbation theory. Now, this particular band that you say, 7 into 10 power minus 5, this is also a little tricky, because if I see how all of these constraints, all of these measures that quantify Kerness behave with amplitude, I see that they have a amplitude squared kind of a dependence, except till here. So if I plot it for this, all of them seem to have a amplitude square. Suddenly for this one, they start deviating. Each of them have a different power law. So this is like, this is the edge of where you can kind of believe perturbation theory. So that's that was like one of the, that's one of the main results that we have in the paper. Like, at least pick a time that is about a cycle and a half from the merger.
Why not do something different? Where when you superpose something, you're violating the constraints as well. So
we actually resolve the constraints, and we do see that there's a slight difference in the mass and the fire spin of the final black hole, which is exactly why this particular band is slightly different, because we have about a point. We have about 10% difference.
But you don't need to compare with anything, right? So I can just imagine some given perturbation of amplitude A.
Mm-hmm.
I put it there and let the system evolve, and I see what the signal is.
So
right? I change that perturbation, and I get the amplitude, the waveforms, divide by the amplitude, and see when do they start peeling off each other.
Exactly. We thought of this. The only problem with this is, so all of this has been done with spec, and we didn't have an infrastructure to do this. So there's a student called
Matt. What do you mean you don't have infrastructure? You're talking you already have this solver.
We have these are initial slices. So there's this guy called Matt Geisler in Caltech who is developing this thing right now. So he's in the process of doing it.
What thing?
Evolving. Like, we have the initial slice, but we have not looked at the evolution properly. So we tried evolving it, and we tried extracting the waveform from it. The extracted waveform were not looking like what we would expect.
So we plot H of T here. What is H of T?
So this H of T is the full binary black hole merger. This is the full binary black hole merger. This is literally the GW5914
okay.
numerical relativity signal.
And so then you just evaluate this invariance or whatever you have written, and then say, at what point do they have a value similar to the
object? Yes. So we use the binary black hole merger of GW5914, take this null race and map the time of each of these slices onto the waveform.
So you're literally comparing apples with oranges and hoping that they tell you something.
I mean, to some extent, I mean, it's not really apples and oranges, right? Like, you know that at the final stage of ring down, it has to look like something like a linear perturbation. You do model it that way, right? Like, you do say that at the end of the ring down, you have sequence-anomal modes.
Yeah, but then you're gauging things with respect to some initial condition that had a black hole with a perturbation that you put by hand. I mean, you put it out of the blue sky. And then you evaluate your speciality indices or whatever. So that is something. I mean, someone else could come and
but
a different
there
shape
is,
of...
There is never a good answer to this question,
sure.
That where linear theory breaks down or what is, I mean...
This analytical black hole perturbation, I could have chosen a different shape of it.
Mm, right.
And
right.
All my conclusions would have changed somehow.
So in this particular thing, we've just put a quadrupolar perturbation. The perturbation is a quadrupolar perturbation that we put in, and the expectation is what you will see will be dominated by a quadrupolar perturbation. Yes, there will be higher mode. Obviously, there should be higher mode perturbation, otherwise you will never see the other quasi-normal modes. But they still you expect them to be weaker, right? So, I mean, this is an approximate mapping, like.
Yeah, I have no problem with the whole approach, but that may be the best you can do, but. You're trying to use these to infer something very sharp, and so that's what I'm following.
Yeah, so we are trying to give an approximate. So okay, the one of the ideas over here is more than to tell you where you should begin your ring down signal. If it's like if the data analysis people make a choice, and essentially the idea would be like, if you do get a plot like this. If you do pick up something that happens like that, then at least this gives you a handle to say that no, you have a large perturbation in the source frame, and you are at a region where you can't even, you know, an amplitude of this kind of a violation can't even be put in as an initial slice.
But what can I not ask that question to the data itself? I forget about numerical relativity, who cares what these guys are telling us?
Uh-huh.
You just say, you go to data analysis, you look for these with your basis, and then you ask, am I getting consistent answers? Because if I started, let's say, put I blindly, and then you just try to match the signal with my ring down basis at 20 milliseconds before the merger, I'm going to get crap. And I just keep sliding it. And at some point, I'm going to start converging on some set of outcomes. It's okay, for, from here on, I have something that's sensible.
How do you know you get crap? What do you mean by you get crap? So, I mean,
I'm just saying, if I try to use the quasi-normal approach to analyze a signal,
you can get, if you put enough of them, you can fit everything, right?
No,
it's
just
like
saying,
epicycles.
And... No, because you don't have the error basis. And so I'm going to just use it, just imagine three orbits before the spiral. That's when you're trying to get anything. So you're going to get some answer. And then you just slide it. And then you say, at what point my scatter, because I'm going to get all sorts of different answers, they begin to converge. And then I can.
But the
operations.
errors also get bigger, so that's it's not the scatter.
No, they will probably go up, and then they will get bigger because the signal went down. Right.
But that's the problem, right? This is the errors, I mean, so
well,
at some point they all kind of. Yeah,
sure,
yeah.
But let me give you all that. I mean, but these sort of arguments need not help at all. You still aren't going to be in the same situation.
So one thing, for instance, is like we see that when you have so in the GW 15 and 914 parameter estimation, they put a start time of 3 milliseconds, and they still see a consistent result. However, a consistent result primarily because the spread in the recovery is like 45 hertz, right? So it's not a very precise thing. Maybe if you had a stronger signal, the contour would have shrunk to some other place. Now, that's what we're expecting here, because a 3 millisecond is far before what I think we can call a perturbation regime. So it's just a gauge how much modeling error. So. In that plot, it's hard to disentangle what comes out of the statistics, you know, what comes out of because of a statistical error and what comes because of a modeling error. This is kind of to give you an insight about how much do you expect an error creeping out of your the modeling side. How much do you think you are violating the linearity constraint, and how much deviation you'll get just because of that, as opposed to. Because over there, it's a combined thing, right? There you can't really say how much you lost because your modeling was wrong versus how much you lost because your data had noise in it. So this is more of an intuitive thing. Like, it's more to give an intuition of to check what you've picked, whether it makes sense or not, rather than precisely saying this is how you need to pick it. So this is the plot where I show you the implication of this whole process onto the data analysis. So what you see here, 100% SNR is picked to be at the merger. And as my signal rings down, I see that this is how I lose my SNR. So one thing that sadly happens is, even in the first region where I think the linear perturbation is valid, I've already lost my signal to around 40%. Like my signal, we have lost 60% of the signal.
So what is this access?
This is the time of the ring down.
In what
code
unit?
In code units, so T over M.
But that's a big number. T over M is 3,000.
Probably 5 orbits.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's the same number that you will see.
Same as that. Okay.
Same as that one. Same as this.
So 3,000.
Right. And these lines are when they correspond to different percentage decreases. So one intuition that we have is the effect systematics of modeling seems to be much less important to a data analysis than what they will find out at the statistical error. So we can kind of afford to not have a very precise start time in terms of modeling, just because you are going to lose about 60% of the SNR by here. And considering that your peak SNR is not going to be so much for the merger, for the whole ring down, that is probably going to be what is going to be more worrisome factor for someone who's trying to find these frequencies in the data. So this was one of the conclusions that we had. And to quickly summarize, in this project, we try to numerically classify the manifold locally into a curve space-time. Then we try to map this curveness onto the waveform. And we do confirm that all of these measures decay down to zero, which shows that the final remnant, at least in the context of numerical relativity, looks like a curved black hole. And We see one thing that the geometric measures settle first close to the black hole and the algebraic measure settles outside first. And then we get an insight about how the statistics and the systematics plays. And at this point, we think that the statistics is going to be the dominant source of error in doing this quasi-normal mode analysis as opposed to the modeling side. And to just quantify that, when we are about 50% violating the constraint, which is like 7.5 to 5 times 10 to power minus 3 perturbation amplitude, we have about 20 to 30% SNR left in your signal. Thank you.
Questions for Swetha? Anybody other than Luis? Say Neil, yeah.
So when you read this slide, right, you know, so you said that your basis is complete in like the non-Kernis. I was just like confused like what that means.
The characterization is complete. So given the generic manifold, I can tell you whether I can completely tell you whether this is a local isometry to curve or not. If I go through it's essentially the reflection of this slide.
Right.
So if I begin with the generic space-time, I can completely characterize the...
So my initial space-time didn't look like a quadrupole or distortion from curve, and instead looked like a smiley face or a pirate ship or something like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, this basis you're saying would be able to represent that initially, because it didn't look like that.
No. I'm not talking about the basis at all.
It's not the basis. It's just a bunch of numbers. That's it.
So each of them are constraints like this. So each of them are constraints on your wild tensor, on the properties of your wild tensor evaluated at each point on the waveform. Each point on the manifold, on the numerical manifold. So essentially here, what we are trying to do is we are trying to just do a manifold classification in some ways. I'm trying to see.
Okay, so then like the statement about being complete, I mean,
I don't understand what it means to be complete.
So initially, like for instance, the work that you were saying about the Campanelli et al., they went up to here, they went up to algebraic special manifold. Given a manifold, they could tell whether it's algebraically special or not. They could also go to Petrov D in some ways, not entirely. They went to Petrov D by just looking at the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the system. So now we have a way of figuring out if the manifold is algebraically special, then to go to Petrov D. And we can also further put more constraints to get to Kerr manifold. So these constraints are like on the data development, we check if the killing vectors behave in the way that you want, you expect the Kerr to behave.
I can take give me Kerr, and I just mess it up completely by calling it changes. And I give it back to you. You don't know what it is. What she's saying is that if you go through all this exercise, at the end of the day, you can do, check. It is
curved. Yeah, so
that's all.
So this is a gauge invariant. You can put whatever coordinate you want. You can slice your space-time any way you want.
And it only tells you
these numbers you were, I mean.
Because she was off curve.
Right, yeah. So you had these numbers of like 50% non-cur.
Mm-hmm.
So that isn't like a yes, no, cur, not cur question. That's like a
right.
Continuous.
These are numbers, right?
So the violation in some way characterize how far away I am from Kerr, which is why I'm not giving you just the numbers. That's which is why I'm trying to connect it onto a analytical perturbation with given amplitude, so I can actually tell you what amplitude this corresponds to. So this is a way of me saying how far away the particular manifold is from Kerr, and this measures. Obviously, none of these measures actually are like telling you quantitatively how different the potential, you know, the curvature is. For instance, these, for instance, tell you how different your principal null directions are from what you expect to. Them to be from curve. Like, so algebraically special literally means like, do you have double coinciding? Like in Petrov D, you'll have a double coinciding null directions, right? So I'm checking for that in this stage. And once I have that, then I'll check for geometric properties, like the symmetry properties, like the killing vectors in this stage.
It's a simple question there. What happens if you use a Schwarzschild black hole to check your evolution?
What happens if I use a Schwarzschild black hole to check what?
Ignoring spin.
And can you explain that again? Sorry.
If you use a Schwarzschild black hole
uh-huh.
to start the thing.
You mean two Schwarzschild black holes or one single?
You're checking to see how curved it is. away from the squash.
Or squash it is careful.
So yeah, squash. Yeah, I'll still have it to be.
Yeah, so that's why also you're saying the systematics will also creep in, because this exercise will tell you, yes, it's correct car and you're 30% off. That already is a problem, because we have to define what 30% is for a spectral measure, and that's why she was doing this exercise with induction and perturbation. But it will tell you you're 30% away from Kerr in some measure, but you don't know what Kerr. The mass and spins are still unknown. These are something that you're getting from the Inspiro with some errors.
So, are there questions? Luis, you can ask questions now. So I do have something. It seems to me what might be more promising. I think cuts are always arbitrary in data, and they can never be exact and whatever is done. So what always seems more promising to me is if you could just parameterize, like the way PPN works is, I mean, if you just in a spiral, you just parameterize possible deviations. And as long as you don't get very close to the measure, then this is fine. The question is, can you do the same parameterization, but actually that works all the way through? So some parameterization of deviations that smoothly connects to the in-spiral, basically. And that seems like more promising.
Well, it's being done.
It's being done.
In the quasi-normal modes?
Yeah, everything.
Oh, so
but she's
the
going after
then?
A particular question. So there is, you're using in-spiral merger and ring down, and you're stitching everything together, and then there are fancy names that people throw out. EOB motivated.
Right.
More analytical than the panel. That's all.
No, but EOB is not doesn't have the right.
No, but at some point you have to decide from here on I'm going to match onto the Poisson modes, and that's this way.
But that's what I'm saying, that you don't want it to be a sharp transition.
No, you can parameterize and you move around, but then as she was saying, as you move around, then you might lose some of the signals.
That's the statement. You're saying that, okay, so I ignore data before some time, and then assume that it's quasi-normal mode after some time. And it's never going to be a good statement, because you're going to have like a sharp jump in.
Oh, but there are some tests that you could do where you would like this. So for instance, you could have, that's what we're saying during the workshop, we could have boson star mergers that would produce a black hole at the end of the day, which has the right speed and everything, or almost the right speed. So we'd like to do an analysis on the spiral. And so GR would predict this one and the quasi-normal mode, go after it. And if you're not agreeing with that, then it's okay, something funny happened. So that might be the only way.
But then you're doing it, you're saying, okay, you either fit the spiral or you fit the ring down, and then you see
if I come with the whole thing, right, GR templates will latch onto something, will maximize the SNR, and will tell you, oh, there is something, this seems to be consistent with binary black hole merger happened this way, and you might be fooled into thinking that there was no, that it wasn't a different set of objects that collide. So there are
some. The point is that you're going to get some parameters, and in GR, there's some kind of minimal set of parameters, and beyond GR, you're going to get non-minimal set of parameters. But I'm saying you want to use the same set of parameters for the full time domain, not different parameters for initial.
Right, so that's what they do. So you're doing that. But you might want to do some R test. Right, so
for instance, if you want to look at the spectrum themselves, so if I want to see if, you know, if I look at the spectrum themselves, it's like it's kind of validating the potential, right, the black hole potential. If I'm expecting something else to be changing the potential a little bit, and I'm expecting the spectrum to change, then I will need to go to a point where I, in the ring down, where I can say that, okay, from here is where the linear perturbation theory is valid. From here on, I expect the frequency spectrum to roughly look like this. So I need to say where, at least for the purposes of doing, of course it's going to be a continuous, you won't have a sharp knob of when the perturbation begins, but you still need to know approximately how large your perturbation is, because you really don't want to be in a nonlinear region claiming to do a linear perturbation theory, at least not in a strong nonlinear region.
Well, I think something we should discuss more. I guess I've seen other things that has been done, and none of them was really convincing to me. But, okay. So, other questions? If not, then let's thank Swetha again.